From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
Muchos años después, frente al pelotón de fusilamiento, el coronel Aureliano Buendía, many years later, as he faced the firing squad, Coronel Aureliano Buendía was to remember that distant afternoon when his father took him to discover ice.
That is the first sentence of 100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel Garcia Marquez, arguably one of the greatest opening lines ever written. This hour, we're going to deconstruct the narrative from the opening line to the last breath. We'll talk about great beginnings with novelists Amy Tan and Tom Wolfe, and endings with Jane Hamilton.
That beautiful time is forever past. And you can access it through the dandelion wine in memory. But you're growing old. You're going to die. It's over. That time will never come again.
But not all stories are constructed of words. We'll also talk with composer Vivek Madala.
Every silent film that I've done, I don't leave my apartment for, whatever, 2 or 3 months. I order my groceries off the internet, send out my laundry. Once a week, I go downstairs and check my mail. It's an intense process.
I'm Tom Wolfe, and I've tried writing some fiction myself, but the greatest, most arresting first paragraph of a novel I've ever read comes from a novel by James M. Cain during, in the 1930s entitled The Postman Always Rings Twice. And it begins, "They threw me off the hay truck about noon." That sentence all by itself, to me, is the greatest opening of any novel. "They threw me off the hay truck about noon." I'd swung on the night before down at the border, and as soon as I got up there under the canvas, I went to sleep. I needed plenty of that after 3 weeks in Tijuana, and I was still getting it when they pulled off to the one side to let the engine cool. Then they saw a foot sticking out, and they threw me off. I tried some comical stuff, but all I got was a dead pan, and so that gag was out. They gave me a cigarette, though, and I hiked down the road to find something to eat. That opening, to me, draws the reader in so rapidly, and so completely, that you're into the story of The Postman Always Rings Twice before you know it. You don't. It is so rapid you don't know what has happened to you. In fact, when I was completely unknown newspaper reporter and had been asked to review Norman Mailer's novel An American Dream, I said in the review that it wasn't a bad thriller, really, the book, except that it began with this long-winded Dostoevskian prelude in which you're just waiting for him to just please shut up. And I said that Mailer should start reading some James M. Cain and learn how to start a book. And I said the way to start a book is to say, "They threw me off the hay truck about noon."
We all know a great story when we hear it. Can make us cry, can make us laugh, can make us think. But what is a story? David Freudberg's thought a lot about what a story is. He's written and edited more than 90 full-length radio documentaries. Freudberg says the human story is not just entertainment or information. He believes our stories address and call forth the highest part of people. And Strange Champs asked Freudberg why he spent the last 25 years of his life on other people's stories.
Well, I think we all crave stories from the time we're children listening to our parents or grandparents tell us stories. And I think it's the way that we all seem to get through life. I'm always looking for the universal that underlies what appears to be on the surface, because I think that's what nourishes me the most and what is closest to the truth of any situation. It is the force that's driving people, that's motivating them, the thing that they wake up in the middle of the night thinking about, the glue that keeps them together when the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune assail them. And sometimes they change the world.
For example, you brought some tape in with you today, didn't you?
Yes. Well, one of the people who just astonished me was a woman named Doris Haddock, who has become affectionately known across the country as Granny D, and who seems to draw supporters from all sides of the aisle, and who has made a singular commitment to changing the way our elections are done in this country. And she actually walked across the United States in a kind of symbolic gesture. And I thought this was such an improbable story that I should try to seek her out. And it turned out she was just a couple hours north of our studio outside of Boston. She's in the town of Dublin, New Hampshire. And it seemed like it would really be worth going up to see her. And it certainly was.
This is the route that I took.
Started in Santa Monica,
yeah.
and cut a swath through
Arizona,
the Southwest, Texas,
and Texas,
and then sort of made your way through Arkansas up to
Tennessee, Kentucky, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and to West Virginia,
and then to Washington D.C.
Washington D.C. Right.
Barely 5 feet tall and donning a broad-brimmed straw hat, Granny D set out on her late-in-life odyssey against what might have seemed heavy odds. She is sometimes afflicted with emphysema and arthritis and wears a back brace, but she was propelled by the power of belief.
How can you live with something to know what is happening in this country? It's not an easy thing to do. It's not easy to say that our democracy, of, by, and for the people, has gone down the drain. We've sold it out.
But how do you respond when people say, it's still a great country?
Of course it's a great country.
There's a lot of freedom here. There's a lot of opportunity to succeed.
More than in any other country in the world. But it's not a democracy. And it's getting worse. This is the problem. It's getting worse. And if we don't do something about it and do it fast, then we've lost it. I'm thinking about the legacy. I have 16 great-grandchildren, great-grandchildren. I want them to live in a democracy.
Talk about the power of belief. I mean, you say that actually for a lot of this, she was wearing a back brace during a lot of this walking she did.
I think she began this in her late 80s and ended her walk in the year when she turned 90. And she has arthritis and emphysema, and she just kept battling. She was unable to be vanquished. And the fact of her endurance was so powerful. But when you talked with her to find out why she was so bent on making this public statement, it became clear that it was really coming out of a very deep belief that she held.
You know, we were talking about your attraction to universal themes in people's stories. Do you feel like the people you interview, the people you profile, are all like living examples of, you know, the Joseph Campbell sort of hero's journey? Because a lot of them are people who, you know, have faced extraordinary odds and they've arrived at something.
One of the people we talked to was a young man named Matty Stepanek, who actually passed away in 2004 at age 13, but not before writing two New York Times bestsellers. He was a young, disabled fellow whose family had been really almost destroyed by muscular dystrophy. All of his three siblings had passed away of it. His mother was in a wheelchair the day I came to their basement apartment outside of Baltimore. Matty himself was in a wheelchair, and he had a trach, a tube that went into his throat, which made it very difficult for him to speak, and he actually gasps for breath every few words, as you will hear.
Well, I'm not the only disabled kid in the world. There's a lot of people, not just kids, that are sick in some way, and a lot of them are very sad about life, feeling down in the dumps, and I tell them, appreciate every moment of life. Because even though you live forever in a better place after you die, you should enjoy life on Earth while it lasts. And don't spend whatever time you have on Earth sitting in a corner feeling miserable for yourself. Remember to play after every storm. That's my life philosophy.
What does it mean to play after every storm?
Well, it means we all have life storms, times in our lives that are extremely sad, scary, angry. And instead of just suffering through them and then afterwards just sitting, crying, and waiting to be wiped out by the next one, we should celebrate together that we got through. Then when the next one comes along, work through and pull through and celebrate again. And always remember the bad times, but never dwell on them.
Is it tempting sometimes to just really feel sorry for yourself? Does it ever get you down?
Oh, yes. I get sad, scary, even sometimes angry, but I don't dwell on it. I don't just curl up and wait to die. I live every second of my life. I talk both publicly and a lot at home. I have fun. I'm a normal kid, and I always live life to the fullest. And I not only fight this disease, I triumph over it.
Triumph over it means?
Not to dwell on it, not to just say, I'm sick, my life is terrible, I can't run around and jump, I can't dive into the pool. I rather say, I can't run around, but I can sure as heck roll around pretty fast. I can't dive into the pool, but I can get a water gun and squirt people. So I always see my glass half full, not half empty. Because if we see our glasses as half empty, they may as well be empty all the way.
You know, I just hearing Maddie breathe just about breaks your heart. Was it hard for you to do that interview?
You know, Anne, I will have to say that it was the hardest interview I've conducted in my life, and I've done hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. I was so choked up that it was hard for me to get questions out. And what I was reacting to so strongly was the beauty of his message. It really felt to me like this was some old sage who had come back into a broken boy's body for a few short years to teach the rest of us about patience, about maintaining a positive attitude in the face of adversity, about peacemaking. He said something to me that morning that has stuck with me every day, although I will admit in racing through traffic to get to the studio here today to record our interview, I probably didn't remember it as well as I should have. Maddie said, always let someone else get in line in front of you. And it was such a simple statement of deference and courtesy, but if we all followed that, and particularly if those of us who drive on the roadways around Boston followed it, I think we would have a much more peaceful world.
Hmm. You know, there's a school of psychology, I think it's called narrative psychology, that looks specifically at how we tell our own stories. You know, so if somebody asks you, tell me about yourself or tell me about your childhood, you're going to pick specific memories from your past to give me. And those stories are what you use to construct your own identity. So a narrative therapist might encourage you to change those stories and by doing that, change yourself. But I'm interested in the kinds of stories we choose to tell about ourselves as we construct our lives. And I was struck listening to some of the profiles you've done that very often there are defining moments in people's lives that they look back on. You know, when they're telling you the story of their life and who they are, there's this moment that really kind of sums up a lot of who they are.
Well, first of all, I'm kind of amused by the idea of a narrative therapist. It sounds like I should book an appointment as soon as possible.
Maybe you are one.
That's even scarier. But oh, yes, we all have these profound turning points that in many ways define who we become. And those pivotal moments, which are often very painful, can turn out to be blessings in disguise. And I'm fascinated by people who walk through those moments with great courage.
You know, the piece of yours I'm thinking about is I'm thinking about the interview you did with the Unabomber's brother.
Mm. Well, I remembered that it was the brother himself who ended up turning in Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, to the federal authorities. And I thought, everybody's focusing on the horror of this terrorist, but the much more interesting story, in a sense, was the brother who had to wrestle in a kind of dark night of the soul with his conscience, torn on the one hand between a natural love one would have for his brother, and on the other hand, torn by the need to protect society from someone who wished ill. I wanted to really understand how you would sort out such a deep emotional conflict like that. How did your mother walk through all of this?
You know, I think we had wanted to spare her for as long as possible. Again, even when we approached the FBI, we didn't feel certain that Ted was responsible. We hoped that they would find some way to rule him out as a suspect. Eventually, I got the call I'd been dreading. An agent that we'd been working closely with said, David, we've done everything possible to rule out your brother as a suspect. Unfortunately, he's moved to the top of our suspect list, and we're now at a point in the investigation where we need to speak with your mom. Do you think you could arrange an interview for us? So I remember going to her apartment. It was on a Saturday morning. She opened the door, and I saw her face change. So obviously my anguish must have been written all over me. And she said, David, something's wrong. You've got to tell me. What is it? And I said, yeah, Mom, I think you better sit down. Her first reaction was a mother's reaction, perhaps a mother's intuition, is, it's Ted. Is it something about Ted? And I said, well, Mom, as far as I know, he's in good health, but I do have something very troubling to tell you. She sat down in this little lazy boy chair where I always picture her reading or watching television. I was much too agitated to sit down. I was kind of pacing the room back and forth, trying to find some way to deliver this news painlessly, but there was no way to do that. Before long, I'm crying a little bit. Mom's just sitting in that chair, not saying a word, looking at me with this fixed look of horror on her face. And, you know, I'm realizing not many relationships are tested in quite this cruel way. How could I be certain she'd even love me after I told her what I'd done? I kind of got to the end of what I had to say and said, Mom, I think there's a chance Ted might be involved. Mom, I've even taken the step of calling the FBI, and they're currently investigating him. And I'll always remember what Mom did next. I mean, it was just extraordinary, a real extraordinary gesture. She got up out of her chair, and she's a very small woman. I'm a little over 6 feet tall. She's a little under 5 feet tall. And she walked up to me, reached up her arms around my neck, and put a kiss on my cheek. And the first thing she said was, David, I can't imagine what you've been going through. Extraordinary to me that in this most terrible moment, her first concern was for my feelings. And then she said probably the most comforting things I could have heard. She said, David, I know that you love Ted. I know that you wouldn't have done this unless you felt like you had to.
That's one of the most moving pieces of tape I've heard. I mean, just the quality of love in the mother's response and in the brother's struggle also, but that's very beautiful.
Well, it occurred to me that the story had so many levels to it. On the surface was the level of, you know, capturing a domestic terrorist, but there was bravery, there was a willingness to put right in front of mere family attachments. There was an amazing dimension of forgiveness. And by the way, this was very painful and continues to be for David because his brother Ted has refused to speak to David ever since David turned him in and would not make eye contact with him at the federal legal proceedings. And it was just an amazingly bold life that he's chosen to lead.
Hmm. David, you've been making documentaries and profiles like this for a long time now, and I'm interested in what you've been doing because there's kind of a bigger collective story emerging that's being constructed out of all of the little stories, the smaller stories that you've been making all these years. Do you feel that the kind of stories you tell are your own particular way of trying to change the world?
I am a giant believer in the power of knowledge and information. I really think that the framers of our Constitution had it right when they embedded into the whole system the exchange of ideas in a free society. And I do basically believe, however misinformed sometimes people may be, or however close-minded they may sometimes be, that if we can expose constructive, meaningful, good ideas to the light and allow people to ponder them, that it can hugely change the way communities are run and the way a whole society is run.
David Freudberg is the executive producer at Human Media. He's written and edited more than 90 full-length radio documentaries. Anne Strainchamp spoke with him. Coming up next, you know you've got a good story when you build a seaworthy Viking ship out of 165,321 wine corks.
The cork boat was this pipe dream of mine, but everybody has a cork boat in the back of their mind in one form or another, some dream or some project or some crazy scheme that they've always wanted to pursue.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. John Pollock's career was off and running inside the Beltway. He worked as a speechwriter for the House Democratic Whip. He eventually joined President Bill Clinton's speechwriting team at the White House. Then, well, he took a queer turn. He quit to build a boat made entirely out of wine corks. And I don't mean some replica toy boat. I mean a real boat, a 22-foot seaworthy Viking ship. I, of course, wanted to know more.
I first got the idea for building a cork boat when I was 6 years old. I built another boat hammered together from old orange crates and split firewood and got all the neighbors to come down to the pond in the neighborhood for the launch, and it sank. And I decided that the next boat I built, I would have to build out of something guaranteed to float. And I started thinking about, well, what can't you sink? And I thought, well, you can't sink a cork, so it would be impossible to sink a lot of corks. And I started collecting them one by one from my parents' dinner table with the intention of building a boat.
When was it that you finally began to go back to this project? I mean, did you have it in the back of your mind all the time?
I had it in the back of my mind all the time. It's just that my parents weren't drinking fast enough. And I, of course, at a certain age, began to contribute my own stream of corks. Saving corks in our family always was something of a running joke. You know, when are you going to build the boat? And I'd say, it's coming, keep saving your corks. And I decided to revive the project in my early 30s when I was working on Capitol Hill, and it was post-impeachment, and I was tired of the trench warfare of Washington. And I decided I needed a creative sabbatical. And why not build the boat?
Yeah, and it turned out to be more of a project than you thought it was going to be. But you had friends. You conned a couple of friends almost immediately into joining you in the project, right?
Well, it was a team effort in terms of producing the corks and in terms of designing and building the boat. My friend Garth Goldstein joined me when I pitched the project to him. He was a young architect and a great outdoorsman and just a great guy. And I thought he would be the perfect partner to build the boat together.
This is a guy you'd known pretty much all your life.
Right. He was from Ann Arbor, but living in Washington. And he got the idea of a cork boat right away. The cork boat, people either hear about it and think, wow, that's a great idea. Or they think, you're nuts. Why would you do that? And he got the whimsical spirit of it all from the get-go.
We ought to talk a little bit about what's involved in a cork boat, because I have to admit that when you talk about collecting corks, it doesn't immediately translate into a vessel that I'd be willing to step on.
Well, imagine a boat that's about 20 feet long, 4.5 feet, 5 feet wide, shaped like a Viking ship almost, with a big sweeping prow, a mast, a square sail, and 4 long crew oars to enable rowing. And that's ultimately what the boat became. That's what it looks like.
Wow. For one thing, that's a lot of corks, right?
It's 165,321 corks in the final boat. But we had to collect a lot more corks than that, because not every cork is worthy of a boat. Some are broken, some are moldy, some are made up of bits and pieces glued together. We needed the best corks and got bars and restaurants saving in Washington, D.C.
But how did you convince them to help you out?
The cork boat was this pipe dream of mine, but everybody has a cork boat in the back of their mind in one form or another, some dream or some project or some crazy scheme that they've always wanted to pursue. And I think that people liked the cork boat for that reason, because they could identify with it on some human level, whether or not they liked boats or not.
Yeah.
And we got over 100 volunteers ultimately to help build the boat. There's no glue in the entire vessel. It's attached with 15,000 rubber bands and a lot of commercial fishnet.
We have to back up, though, for a minute, because I know what you did with those corks, because I looked at the diagrams in your book. But when you say you put a bunch of corks together with rubber band and fishnet, that doesn't tell the new listener to you much about what you did. It sounds like you threw a bunch of corks in the bathtub and then sat on top of them.
Okay, I can explain it. If you take 7 corks and stand them on end in a cluster and pop a rubber band around the outside of them, they'll compress and form a hexagon. And you can scale up the size of those hexagons with a bigger rubber band around the perimeter. And we made hexagons approximately the size of a dinner plate. And that disc, as we called them, we could build those on an assembly line, essentially, by hand, but then stack those hexagonal discs one atop the other, joining them vertically with more rubber bands, essentially creating a cork column or a cork log. Uh-huh. And we would wrap that in netting and sew it shut very tightly.
So how did you figure out how many corks you were going to need?
Well, the truth of the matter is that Garth and I wanted to take the boat on a journey, and we figured, well, let's not build a boat that can take 2 people. Maybe we'll bring dates. Let's build it for 4 people.
Well, if you're going to have a dream, you might as well dream.
The idea was to go through European wine country. And that was Garth's insistence that if we're going to build a boat, it's just as easy to build a big one as a small one. I thought, you're right, we should build a big boat.
Yeah. And of course, if you're going to go through the wine country, there would always be replacement corks if you needed them.
Exactly, if we sprang a leak. And so we contacted a friend of mine, a naval architect, and based on the buoyancy of cork and some basic principles of naval architecture, came up with a number of corks it would take to float a 160-pound person at waterline. And the number is, I believe, 6,114. And we just scaled up from there and said, okay, well, if that's to float one at waterline, then we need 4 times that just for the 4 people. Then we need gear and the weight of the deck and the sail, et cetera. And we just scaled up from there. The final number came down to the final dimensions of the boat. And
sure.
And the prow, of course, was strictly decorative. It didn't have to be there, but we wanted to build a beautiful boat.
So how long did the cork boat take to build?
Well, it was about 30 years to save the corks and ultimately about 3 years to build the boat and get it into the water.
And you really did have to decide that a deadline was something you understood from work life that was going to have to apply to the cork boat as well if it was ever going to get to the water.
Right, and that was an interesting dynamic between Garth and me. Garth is a perfectionist, a super talented designer, and he always was sketching away and designing the perfect boat sometime in the future. And I was more of the logistics and operations guy, and I was always pushing to recruit more volunteers to hash out some of the construction challenges to keep the project moving forward and actually build the boat and getting it into the water.
There's so much more to this story. I'm really sorry we can't get to it. But you did go to Portugal, and you did travel with a cork boat, and the cork boat's still there, right?
We spent 17 days traveling down the Douro River through the heart of Portuguese wine country from the Spanish frontier to the Atlantic Ocean at Porto. We thought it would be a five-day trip. It ended up taking 17 days of hard rowing, usually into a stiff headwind. But the people of Portugal really embraced the cork boat, Portugal being the home of cork. And, of course, rowing through the heart of wine country and the land of great navigators, the cork boat got a great reception.
And where is it now?
It's in a warehouse outside of Porto, and I'm hoping that when the book comes out in Portuguese this year, that I'll be able to donate it to Portugal's Cork Museum.
John Pollock is the author of the aptly titled Cork Boat.
I'm Amy Tan, and my favorite story, the beginning of a story, is from Lolita. Lolita, light of my life, you know, and the way that it goes, lo, lo, lo. I love that beginning. It is so sensual, and it captures the obsession of the narrator and what we're going to find out later on. It is also so beautiful about what language can do, that the very sensual nature of, you know, the tongue hitting the palate to create that L sound is part of the beauty of what writers love, and it is about language. And that's captured right there in the beginning of the story.
I'm Jim Fleming. What's your favorite beginning to a novel? Why not send us an email through our website at www.ttbook.org? It's to the best of our knowledge. From PRI, Public Radio International.
National support for To the Best of Our Knowledge is provided by Powell's Books, an independent bookseller since 1971, presenting powellsbooks.blog, a window to the world of literature, authors, and up-to-date book news on the web at powells.com.
With silent film from the 1920s, technology didn't exist to really easily marry the picture with the sound, so you had real-time accompaniment. As a result, we have all these silent films from the 20s that never really had an actual score married to them. In order for Turner Classic Movies to re-release or to air these films, they need a new soundtrack.
That's composer Vivek Madala. He's a judge for Turner Classic Movies' annual Young Film Composers Competition. The event invites young composers to write and perform music for previously unscored silent films. Before Madala was a judge at the competition, he was a contestant, and he won. Steve Paulson asked Madala what it was like to win the competition.
I had actually, believe it or not, never written anything for film before. I had been writing music since I was a small child, but I had always wanted to write music for film, but I never really had an opportunity. I wasn't quite sure how to break into the business, and so I heard about this competition. Turner Classic Movies had 4 different film clips on their website, and you could download the 4 clips, pick one, and write music for it. So I picked this Valentino scene from Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, and I really didn't know what I was doing, actually. And in fact, I think that maybe worked in my favor. I wrote music that was, I guess, perceived as bold and unconventional, although I didn't really know that at the time. So yeah, I ended up writing what was effectively a tango in a kind of a modern mode.
Well, let's hear it.
Okay.
So what's happening in that scene?
In the beginning of the scene, Valentino appears where he's sort of checking out this woman who he wants to dance with. And it results in a bar fight. And then he grabs her and starts dancing with her. And then so you actually get to see the interaction between the people in the bar who are watching the dance scene and watching the fight. First the fight and then the dancing. And then it's the actual physical dancing.
Now, what you hear in that is movement. I don't know if you're trying to get at the movement of the dancers, or is it the movement of the fight? What is it that you're commenting on?
With silent film music, often you're playing both the drama and the subtext, as well as the action on the screen. And so what I was trying to do with the music was sort of, I guess you could think of it as choreographing the music to the action, as well as sort of reflecting the underlying motivations of the characters.
So did you actually then create the music? I mean, did you go out and hire people to perform all of those instruments?
Actually, I played all the instruments myself.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I have my own recording studio in my house at the time in my apartment in San Francisco. I actually recorded that in my one-bedroom apartment on Lombard Street in San Francisco.
Oh, wow. So what did you win?
I won the opportunity to score a feature film from the 1920s. In fact, it was the 1921 Lon Chaney film, The Ace of Hearts, with an orchestra in Hollywood.
So a whole film?
Yeah, it was 74 minutes of wall-to-wall score.
That must have been fun.
Fun, yeah. Yeah, it was fun. It was, well, the thing is, writing 70, 80, 90 minutes of music in a 2 or 3 month period for an orchestra, you know, that's a lot of work and it's pretty intense. And with a silent film of this scale, you know, typically I have to write anywhere, depending on where I'm in the schedule, anywhere from 1 to 3 minutes of music a day that's fully orchestrated and fully sequenced. And so
that does sound intense. Yeah,
it's very intense. You know, when I was working on The Ace of Hearts, in fact, every silent film that I've done, I don't leave my apartment for whatever 2 or 3 months. I order my groceries off the internet, send out my laundry. Once a week, I go downstairs and check my mail. It's an intense process.
Well, you went on to score a number of movies for Turner Classic Movies, and another one was The Mysterious Lady with Greta Garbo.
That's right.
Let's hear some of that. Now, I haven't seen this movie, but I know that something bad is about to happen here. It sounds like Garbo's lover is being marched off to the firing squad or something like that.
Yeah, it's in fact, he's in the Austrian army. This is circa 1914. This is right before World War I. He's being court-martialed for treason, and he's actually been framed by Greta Garbo. This was a really, I think, a great film. Oddly enough, I'd never seen a Garbo picture before I scored this picture, but after spending 3 months looking at the screen, looking at Garbo on the screen, I can totally see why people are such Garbo maniacs.
Now, one thing that's so striking about this music is the chorus. I mean, that just adds to the intensity of the scene.
Yeah, you know, it's really funny. This was a cue that I had been wanting to write for years, since I was a kid. I'd always wanted to write some sort of a, you know, Wagner-esque, big, you know, almost a something reminiscent of Carmina Burana. And the scene kind of provided the dramatic context for me.
You know, I have to tell you, I've come to a new appreciation of the power of music in the movies because I've been watching The Lord of the Rings, the three movies, with my kids who are 7 and 9, and they're kind of scared of the movies, especially the younger one. And I realized it was the music that scared them more than anything, and that actually if you remove the music from it, it wasn't nearly as scary. And it was just, I really came to see how much music drives the emotion of a movie.
Yeah, you know, it is interesting to me the extent to which music can evoke an emotional response in the audience in a way that seeing something can't necessarily do. You know, it is interesting how two different pieces of music against the same picture can actually make the picture look different and make the experience of watching it be completely different.
Explain what you mean by that.
Well, when I was in college, I took a class that was actually taught by a professor who had a dual PhD in electrical engineering and in music composition. And he played us a film clip. It was children playing on a playground, and it was just the sounds of the children playing. And then he played us the exact same film clip with, you know, almost a Disney-like light orchestral soundtrack, and it sort of accompanied the action on the screen. And then he played us the exact same thing again, but with very ominous-sounding orchestration and composition. There was cello and double bass in a sort of a dissonant chordal pattern, and then sort of eerie woodwinds and strings up top. And it actually made the picture look different. It was the exact same picture, but it somehow my interpretation of what was happening, you know, obviously was quite different than it was in the previous version that he showed us. And it was actually at that point that I realized how a lot of what we understand about what we're seeing in a film is affected by the music.
Now, we've been talking about music that tends to be scary or very dramatic. Of course, there are lots of other kinds of movie scores as well, comedies and romances. And you did a score for the romantic comedy The Patsy with Marion Davies. And let's hear some of that.
Okay.
So when you're creating music for a lighter film, a romantic comedy, what do you try to do? I mean, why is that so recognizably romantic music?
I think there's kind of a universal language, a common vernacular, musical vernacular, that we as consumers of Western cinema have become familiar with. When you hear kind of a light waltz of that style, I think maybe that sort of just connotes romance. Writing music for a silent film, I think, is significantly different than it is for a talkie, if you will. With a silent film, it's, I think, more like writing music for a ballet, where the music and the picture are sort of equal partners. I mean, obviously, the music serves the picture, serves the drama, but there aren't other components to the sound, such as dialogue and sound effects, that you're competing with. The music needs to constantly engage the listener or the viewer. The music, I think, it has to do a lot more. With a more modern film, like a first-run feature, for example, often the music can sort of just play mood or texture. And with a silent film, it has to do a lot more.
But the other thing that you have to do is, in some ways, you have to get back into the mindset of a 1920s film. I mean, you can't use modern sure. instrumentation. You have to make it sound old.
I'm glad you brought that up. One of the things that I think Turner Classic Movies is looking for is, I don't want to say necessarily a modern interpretation, but when they hire me to score a silent film, I think really part of the specification is for me to bring the film into the new century. And so while I am using orchestral instruments that existed, say, at the turn of the century, a lot of the harmonies that I use, a lot of the musical constructs didn't exist in the 1920s. I'm really more of a jazz musician. And so when you listen to my scores for these silent films, I'm drawing largely from like late 19th century romanticism. But you'll also hear some, you know, John Coltrane and Miles Davis in the music. You'll hear some Bill Evans influences. In fact, there were some cues from the Patsy. There was one where there was even a subtle Jimi Hendrix reference, although it was with bassoon and oboe. I tend to draw on more modern harmonies and things that maybe hadn't been invented when these films came out. And I think that can really serve the picture well, especially for modern audiences.
Vivek Madala is a film score composer. Steve Paulson spoke with him.
This is Jane Hamilton, and one of my favorite endings is All the King's Men, and it's by Robert Penn Warren, who now graces a postage stamp. You can go down to your post office and get them right now. This is a story about a hero and a heroine who have been childhood sweethearts. They grow up, they get involved with state politics, they are injured, they learn hard lessons, and then they get married, and this is the very end. So by next summer we shall have left Burden's Landing. We shall come back, no doubt, to walk down the row and watch young people on the tennis courts by the clump of mimosas, and walk down the beach by the bay, where the diving floats lift gently in the sun, and on out to the pine grove, where the needles thick on the ground will deaden the footfall, so that we shall move among the trees as soundlessly as smoke. But that will be a long time from now. And soon now we shall go out of the house and go into the convulsion of the world, out of history, into history, and the awful responsibility of time.
Wow, that's terrific. Why do you like that so much?
Well, there's a category of endings, including Dear Reader, I Married Him. Then we buried Hector. There's the teenage coming of age story where the narrator is older, wiser, and sadder. You know, those are a few. So in choosing my favorite ending, I had to choose the type of ending. And, you know, I'm still, even in middle age, fond of the marriage ending. But I like an ending to have a tinge of melancholy. And I think that The King's Men serves that purpose very well. The couple who have gotten married are older, sadder, wiser, middle-aged. They're broken, but it's a beautiful thing that they come together. And, you know, I suppose maybe by today's standards, this ending is a tiny bit sentimental because there's the sense that there is providence in the fall of the sparrow, that everything we do matters, that we do have a responsibility to time, and that is... you know, kind of a terrifying reassurance.
Well, my sense also from the passage you just read is there's a sense of summing up of bigger ideas. I mean, it sort of it goes from the particular to something larger.
Yes, and it's always nice to have a little bit of nature in there, although I guess Elmer Leonard says never begin a book with nature. But a lot of endings do end with nature, as I was, you know, reading through this. I would have liked, in a way, to choose Dandelion Wine, because that is the ending in the category of the eulogy ending. The past is past. It's permanently over. It will never come again. But I couldn't read it without bawling, and I thought that would not be, a wise thing to do on the radio.
It could be kind of interesting. I don't know.
It's really sad. You know, he shuts his eyes, he goes to sleep, and thus endeth the summer of 1928 forever. It will never come back, ever.
Well, you actually did bring your copy. Could you read it for us?
Well, Dandelion Wine by Ray Bradbury is a recollection of a summer of boyhood. And during the course of it, he makes dandelion wine, which distills the summer for him. June dawns, July noons, August evening's over, finished, done, and gone forever, with only the sense of it all left here in his head. Now a whole autumn, a white winter, a cool and greening spring to figure sums and totals of summer past. And if he should forget, the dandelion wine stood in the cellar, numbered huge for each and every day. He would go there often, stare straight into the sun until he could stare no more, then close his eyes and consider the burned spots, the fleeting scars left dancing on his warm eyelids, arranging, rearranging each fire and reflection until the pattern was clear. So thinking, he slept, and, sleeping, put an end to summer 1928.
So why does that get to you so much?
Oh, there's just that elegiac sense that that beautiful time is forever past. And you can access it through the dandelion wine and memory, but you're growing old. You're going to die. It's over. That time will never come again.
It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can buy a tape of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Constructing the Narrative, program number 522B. To the Best of Our Knowledge, the recipient of the 2005 Peabody Award, is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Steve Paulson, Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, Anne Strainchamps, Mary Lou Finnegan, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our technical director is Kirill Owen, and we have special thanks this time for Carmen Jackson.
PRI, Public Radio International.